All right, Mark chapter 6, verse 1. Jesus went out from there and came into his hometown. And his disciples followed him. And when the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue. And the many listeners were astonished, saying, "Where did this man get these things? And what is this wisdom given to him, and such miracles as these performed by his hands? Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? Are not his sisters here with us?" And they took offense at him. Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and among his own relatives and his own household. And he could do no miracle there except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and healed them. And he wondered at their unbelief. And he was going around the villages teaching." Let's pray. Father, we thank you for the blessings of this day. And I just pray that you would bless our time tonight as we gather here and study your word. We pray that you would speak to us. Just give us wisdom and understanding. Help us to apply what we learned tonight into our lives. And just give us a greater knowledge of you, knowledge of your word, and greater knowledge of how you work in our lives. We just thank you for all you do for us. We thank you for Christ, what you give us in him, and for just coming into our lives and being gracious to us, and changing our hearts, and drawing us, saving us. And so, Lord, we pray you would be glorified tonight and strengthen us and make us more like Christ, in whose name I pray. Amen. Okay, well, the title tonight, Jesus Rejected at Nazareth, and that, of course, is the passage I just read there from Mark 6. And there are a couple other passages in the Gospels that are very similar to this, parallel passages, perhaps. If not, they're very close. On what happened when Jesus went back to Nazareth. And the reason I'm bringing this up tonight, it kind of ties in with what I was talking about Sunday morning with Mary. And when I was talking about Mary, I was talking about when Simeon told her, "A sword will pierce your soul." And then earlier, a little bit earlier than that, when she was told, "Favored one, the Lord is with you." And I said, well, she was going to need the Lord with her. And when it speaks of her being favored, it means graced, one who is favored with grace. And so God had been gracious to Mary, which, of course, ties in a lot with what I was talking about Sunday, about the fact that you don't need grace unless you're a sinner, because if you're perfect, if you're divine, you don't need grace. But the Bible says that Mary received grace. And she was going to need that. She was going to need God to be with her in a special way because of what she was going to face in her life. It was not going to be easy. And she didn't know everything that was going to happen, but she was told, "The sword will pierce your soul." And, of course, I think directly that's a reference probably to the crucifixion that she would witness. But when you look at her life, there were a lot of really, I think, probably very difficult times, stages, even the majority of her life. And one of the things I'd mentioned Sunday was the fact that, of course, they end up leaving, Joseph and Mary and Jesus, they leave for a couple of years. They're in Egypt until they're called back. And what's interesting, and I'm going to get into this Sunday, Lord willing, I'm planning to preach on Joseph this Sunday. When they came back from Egypt, after 2 years, it's interesting, the Bible says that Joseph was warned in a dream not to go to Judea, but to go back to Galilee. And as I'd mentioned last Sunday, I said, you know, it would have been easier from a human perspective. It would have been easier with all the controversy surrounding Mary's pregnancy, the birth of Christ, you know, the rumor mill that must have been rampant in Nazareth, which was a small town anyway, a small village. This everyone knows her to be a righteous young lady, and she ends up pregnant. I mean, that had to have been scandalous. It would have been easier to say, you know what, let's raise him in Jerusalem. Let's just move to the big city. Let's get away from the fishbowl where everybody knows us and they're all going to be talking about us our whole lives. Let's just go to Jerusalem. Now, when I said that Sunday, I wasn't really thinking about it, but the passage does say that Joseph, when he came out of Egypt, did go toward Judea, which, you know, is Jerusalem. But an angel told him, no, don't go there. Raise the child in Galilee. And so I think Joseph had the same idea I did, that hey, it's going to be a lot easier on us if we get out of Nazareth. And God said, no, go back to Nazareth. And so that's what happens. And Jesus is raised in Nazareth, which, by the way, is a fulfillment of prophecy. He shall be called a Nazarene. That wouldn't have worked if you raised him in Jerusalem. So God had a plan there, and he saw to it that Joseph didn't mess it up, like I would have messed it up. So the whole idea of Nazareth, that's kind of what I had in mind in talking about this. I mentioned this passage just in passing on Sunday, and just some of the problems that Mary had to have encountered. I mean, they all knew the history and the birth of Christ and the questioning of who his father was. I mean, these types of things are hard to live with in a small town, and particularly when you're innocent. You know, I mean, that makes it doubly hard. I mean, if she was guilty, then in one sense you say, okay, well, this is mine to bear because I sinned. But she didn't. And so to have to go back to Nazareth and deal with all that had to have been difficult. And so what I wanted to look at tonight was the passage here where Jesus goes back to Nazareth. And it's such an interesting dynamic there, because when you think of this, they grew up with him. What was that like? They know he wasn't a brat, right? I mean, the people in Nazareth that grew up with him, he was the sinless Son of God. What was it like playing on the playground with him? What was it like going to school with him? What was it like having him help his dad carpentry shop? And even after he came of age and was a carpenter himself, I mean, what was it like being around him? What's it like being around the sinless Son of God? And so, you know, oftentimes when somebody from small town, whatever, they make it big, well, you go back to the small town, and there's plenty of people who want to take shots at him, right? Oh, I knew him when he was in fifth grade. He was a total brat, blah, 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 blah. And usually they're jealous, but still, what are they going to say about Jesus? I mean, he's without sin. And so it's interesting, when he comes back, in one sense, they are somewhat impressed with him. I'm going to read a couple of different passages here in a moment where it says, for example, in Nazareth, they marveled at the gracious words that were coming from his lips. And so what does that mean? On some level, they were amazed at him. I mean, in this passage, they can't figure out where he got all this. He grew up in Nazareth. How does he get all this knowledge? How does he do these miracles? And so it's just, they're not putting two and two together. It's not coming up. It's not, you know, this is Joseph's son, the carpenter from Nazareth. And here he is going around preaching and healing people. And the people saying he's the Messiah. How do we reconcile that with he's our hometown boy? And so that's kind of what I want to get into tonight. Jesus back at Nazareth and the reaction. And then I specifically want to get into a little bit more of what it was that he taught that sparked the reaction in them. And I've got two ideas in mind in terms of Jesus' teaching. One has to do with grace, and one has to do with authority, because both of these things were said of Jesus' teaching. The passage I just referenced where they were amazed at the gracious words falling from his lips, and then there's another passage where it says some of the crowds, when they heard him, they were amazed at his teaching because he did not teach as the scribes, but he taught as one having authority. And so that combination of grace and authority, which almost seem opposites, but how does that come together in the teaching of Christ, and why does it have the reaction that it does in Nazareth? As Christians, we would think, wow, Jesus preaching in your hometown? Boy, couldn't wait to get there. Well, they weren't too impressed. They were at first, and then it took a turn. But that's what I want to talk about tonight. We'll see how far we get and go from there. So, all right, so let's begin with the amazement of the Nazarenes The amazement they have with Jesus, of course, it begins in verse 1. Jesus went out from there, came into his hometown, and his disciples followed him. Now, that's very telling. It tells us there that his disciples followed him. So Jesus, I mean, up to now, he's been out doing ministry. I mean, he's gone out, he's healed people. They've heard about it, because in another passage, it says, it's where Jesus says, I'm sure you all are going to quote to me, physician, heal thyself. All the things you did in Capernaum, come and do them in your hometown as well. And so he's been out doing that, and, you know, he's done his miracles, and he had the association there with John the Baptist, and he was baptized, and he's called his disciples, and he's traveling, and messianic questions about him. People are wondering, is he the Messiah? People wondered, is John the Messiah? And so there's this kind of fever pitch within Judaism at that time as Messiah perhaps coming on the scene. And when you start hearing rumors that, well, Jesus might be the Messiah, and you're from Nazareth, he can't be the Messiah. He's from here. I've known him from almost the day he was born. There's no way he's the Messiah. And so there's big questions about that. And so when it says here that he came into his hometown and his disciples were with him, that's kind of a tip-off to us. This is not a trip home to visit family. He's not going to go, and oh, I'm going to go see how Mary's doing and my brothers and sisters. That's not what he's doing. This is a ministry trip. Disciples are with him. Yeah, he may see family while he's there. It'd be hard not to in a town that small. But this is a ministry trip. And so he goes. Furthermore, you see that because, verse 2, when the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue. And many listeners were astonished, saying, where did this man get these things? And what is this wisdom given to him and such miracles as these performed by his hands? And so initially, it seems like a pretty good reaction. It says he went into the synagogue. It was a different setup than what we view as a typical Sunday morning church. A synagogue service. It wouldn't have been uncommon for him to have been given a scroll to read. You know, there's another passage where it says he reads from Isaiah, and then everyone is staring at him, and he says, this has been fulfilled in your hearing. That's big, you know. I mean, to get up in a synagogue, read from Isaiah, who's considered the greatest prophet, and say, what Isaiah said, yeah, that's talking about me. Can you imagine? They wanted to kill him, actually, after that. And so that's, you know, that's the reaction. Initially, it seems pretty good, but that's how it was in the synagogue. It's not surprising that Jesus comes and he teaches in the synagogue. He would have read a passage from the Old Testament, and then he would have taught on it. And the people are amazed at what they're hearing. Now, it doesn't take long for them to be angered at what they're hearing. Now, here's a question that you might consider. Why did Jesus go there in the first place? Did he... Now, you already read the end there, and we'll get to this in a moment, so don't go off too much on this. Verse 6, it says, he wondered at their unbelief. I'm going to explain what I think that means in a few moments. But also, based upon what he said there about a prophet not being accepted in his hometown, do you think Jesus came into that town expecting they were going to embrace him or knowing they were not going to? Yeah, I think so, obviously. He knows they're not going to embrace him. They're not going to accept him. He knew that going in. He tells you that in the middle of the passage. So why does he go? Why would he go if he knows he's going to get rejected? Isn't that casting pearls before swine, which he tells us not to do? Okay, she says he's witnessing. What'd you say? Well, that's true. But why would it be the Father's will for him to go there if they're all going to reject him? What's that? Yeah. It's definitely on the agenda of the Father's ordained plan that he would teach all through Galilee. Why go to Nazareth? Yep, okay. Well, yeah, undoubtedly I can, in fact, I can tell you a couple of the redeemed who were there. They hated Jesus. Well, it was prophesied that he would be raised there, He'd be called a Nazarene. And it was prophesied that he would go through Galilee, which Nazareth is part of Galilee, so there could be a loose connection there. As to what Kay said, maybe there were some elect there. Some of the elect there were at least two of Jesus' brothers who hated him initially, and I'm going to get into that in a moment, hated him, wanted him to die, and then became the pastor of the Jerusalem church and became the writer of the book of Jude. And so two of his brothers were converted, and that probably wasn't their only chance to hear the gospel, but when you think of him going to Nazareth, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why. Much of his ministry was around, you know, in Galilee, which Nazareth was a part of. And you know there was pressure on him to go back home. Yeah, Wayne, you got something? Right. Yeah, there's a sense in which he's bringing judgment upon them, because he comes there and he preaches and they try to kill him. They're not receiving this message. And, you know, part of that is, as Henry said, is God's plan. He went to a lot of places where he was rejected. And, you know, as he told the disciples, you go to a place, they reject you, wipe the dust off your feet, go to the next place. It'll be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah than it'll be for that city. I mean, that's big-time judgment. And so I think that's part of it. And I do think that it could also potentially be said that it was a fulfillment of prophecy. Van had mentioned that wasn't it prophesied that he would do that. It was prophesied. You could even call this a New Testament prophecy, if you will. But in John chapter 1, verse 11, he came unto his own, and his own received him not. Now, there's different ways you could interpret that. He came unto his own, meaning the Jews, and the Jews received him not, meaning Sanhedrin, Jerusalem, you know, the big shots. He came unto his own city, Nazareth, and they received him not. He came unto the Jews in Nazareth, in the synagogue, and they received him not. He came unto his own family, and they received him not. His brothers rejected him. And so that could be part of it with the whole Nazareth thing. It's just interesting to consider. This is a ministry trip. He goes to Nazareth. He knows it's not going to go well. He goes anyway. Well, the big answer that's always right is, well, it was God's will. Well, that's true, but can we try to figure out what God was doing in having Jesus go there? All right, so they're amazed. And what they're amazed at, one of the things, is his learning. Many listeners, verse 2, many listeners were astonished, saying, where did this man get these things? And what is this wisdom given to him? And so it's interesting the way that's worded, I think. Where does this man get these things? I mean, if it was somebody else coming to town, they would have been impressed. But this man, we know this man. If Saul of Tarsus had come preaching in Nazareth, oh, this is an incredible man. Look at his knowledge of the law. Look at his knowledge of the Old Testament. Look at his knowledge of the Scriptures. This man, though, where does this man get this knowledge? That tells me two things. First of all, this, they're not impressed with Jesus. They've known him his whole life, right? He's a carpenter. He's one of them in their minds. How does he know this stuff? He didn't go study in Jerusalem. How does he know this? And the fact that they say this man, now that tells me that they didn't know or they didn't accept the testimony as to who Jesus was in terms of being divine. He was a man. He's also God. And so they're amazed at that. And, you know, really, when you think about it, humanly speaking, the people that would be least likely to embrace Christ as divine, as the Messiah, as everything the Bible says he is, the ones least likely to accept that would be the Nazarenes, because they knew him. Part of the reason why he says a prophet's not accepted in their hometown. You know, I don't want to trivialize it, but when you think of somebody, I mean, I'm from a small town. We had occasionally someone would kind of make it big, not like world famous, but somebody would make it and, you know, play big time football or, you know, something like that. And there was always a lot of pride. Oh, yeah, he's one of us. He made it big. But there was also always a group of people that wanted to tear him down, right? Well, I played with him in high school. I could have whooped him all over the field. Well, yeah, well, then how come you're not playing for the Sooners then, big shot? Oh, well, I just didn't want to. I hurt my knee. Or, you know, there was always naysayers who were trying to pull someone down. And so it's interesting with Jesus. He goes back and, you know, really, I mean, what criticism are you going to have of him? The perfect, sinless Son of God. And they're amazed, it says, at his wisdom. Now, I think this is interesting in the fact that they acknowledge he has wisdom. So they don't think he's, you know, a snake oil salesman. They don't think he's a con man. They think he's wise. And they're mad about it. Here's a couple of different passages that speak to his wisdom and what it was about it that impressed them. Luke chapter 4, verse 22, it says, this is him in Nazareth, and all were speaking well of him and wondering at the gracious words which were falling from his lips. Gracious words. Now, you can dig into that, and I'm going to here in a moment. What do they mean when they say gracious words? Was he teaching on the theme of grace? Is that what it means by gracious words? Does it mean gracious in the sense of his style? You know, he wasn't confrontational. He was gracious in how he spoke. Well, I suspect both of those could have been the case, but okay, just pack that away. Gracious words, all right? Jesus teaching grace. That's one of the things I want to talk about, but I want to couple that with this one. Mark chapter 1, verse 21, they went into Capernaum, which is close to Nazareth. They went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and began to teach, and they were amazed at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one having authority and not as the scribes. The scribes, of course, were legal experts, legal in the sense of Mosaic law, not constitutional law or anything like that. Legal experts, and the scribes would get together and discuss matters of the law, and they would say, well, I think it means blah, blah, blah. Well, I disagree. I think it means blah, blah, and, you know, just like we do with issues, I mean, theological issues. You might have somebody write a book this big saying predestination is true, and then somebody else writes a book, usually about this big, saying it's not true. And, you know, you write books at each other, you go to conferences, they write papers against each other, and so they're trying to figure it out. None of them really knows what they're talking about. That's what the scribes were. They're trying to figure out the law. They argue about it. They're not sure. Well, I think you can do this on the Sabbath. Well, I don't think you can do that on the Sabbath. And Jesus gets up and just says, flat out the way it is. And that's what they mean when they say, he teaches with authority. He doesn't act like the scribes. And they were amazed at that. You wouldn't expect to hear that from a 30-year-old carpenter from Nazareth. I mean, that's why this is all so unusual to them. And so this idea of Jesus' teaching being both gracious and authoritative, he teaches with authority. They were amazed at the gracious words coming from his lips. All right, I want to take those two ideas and now go to John chapter 8. And look at how those two ideas converge in this incident of the woman caught in adultery and how Jesus handles this entire situation, which is absolutely incredible. If you are the type of person that get caught sometimes in arguments and you lose or people kind of paint you into a corner, you're debating with somebody and, you know, they say, all right, it's either this or this. You pick. Which is it? And you just kind of clam up and you say, well, I'm not sure, I'll go with that one. Hey, guess what? Sometimes there's more than two answers to a question. And that's what Jesus teaches us right here. And this woman caught in adultery, remember they catch her in the act, they bring her in. All right, what do you say, Jesus? Do we stone her or do we not? And Jesus doesn't take the bait. He doesn't answer their questions. It's pretty incredible what he does, incredible the answer he does give them. And so let's read it. John chapter 8, I'm going to begin in verse 3. I'll take a drink because I hear pages turning. That's my cue for some living water. John chapter 8, verse 3. And again, this is under the theme of grace and authority in Jesus' teaching. Here we go. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman caught in adultery, and having set her in the center of the court, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in adultery in the very act. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. What then do you say?" They were saying this, testing him, so that they might have grounds for accusing him. But Jesus stooped down and with his finger wrote on the ground. But when they persisted in asking him, he straightened up and said to them, "He who is without sin among you, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. When they heard it, they began to go out one by one, beginning with the older ones. And he was left alone and the woman, where she was in the center of the court. Straightening up, Jesus said to her, "Woman, where are they? Did no one condemn you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "I do not condemn you either. Go, from now on, sin no more." This is one of the most fascinating pictures in the Bible, in my estimation, because it's a picture of Jesus teaching both grace and authority. Jesus showing both grace and authority. And there's so much mystery that kind of surrounds it there. Namely, him writing on the ground, which I'll get to in a moment. All right, here's the grace in this story. It's pretty obvious, isn't it? Grace is what? He doesn't condemn her. The text never says she was innocent. They just went and dragged some woman off the street and said, "Here, we caught her in adultery. What do you say we do?" I mean, the text never indicates she was innocent. She was, it does appear, guilty. But he doesn't condemn her. And so you see grace in that, clearly. And then you also see authority in that, and how he deals with the scribes and the Pharisees who are bringing this charge against her. He dictates the grounds by which she could be stoned, doesn't he? "He who has no sin, let him throw the first stone. You want to stone her? Fine, stone her. Whichever one of you is without sin can begin the proceedings." So Jesus is in charge of this situation. He's the one with the authority. I mean, they're coming to him asking. They're not coming to him asking because he's a judge and has the authority, at least on an earthly scale, to execute her. They're not interested in executing her. They're interested in trapping Jesus. And if they can get Jesus to actually stone her, boy, that'll really help their cause. A lot of his followers would probably fall away. Well, he's not what we thought he was. And so they feel like they've got him in a perfect trap. You present somebody with two options, and you say, "Look, this is black and white, plain as day. It's either this or this. Jesus, what do you say?" And he does not take their trap. He doesn't fall into the trap. He doesn't take the bait. And so now technically, when they come with this woman caught in adultery, the law of Moses says to stone her. Is that true? Did the law of Moses say to stone adulterers? Yeah, it absolutely did. But let me read for you from Leviticus chapter 20, verse 10, where it speaks of this law. And it's interesting, I think. See if anything catches your attention. Leviticus chapter 20, verse 10. "If there is a man who commits adultery with another man's wife, one who commits adultery with his friend's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death." Does that raise any red flags? What would that be? Exactly, right. Because that verse, in speaking from the Mosaic law about adultery and how that's to be handled, is very clear. It was not to be a case of grab the woman and drag her to a court in front of a bunch of people here and stone her. That wasn't how it worked. First of all, I mean, you had more of a trial type situation, but it mentions two, and this is a particular sin that it takes two. And so it says, in fact, it names first, the husband, the adulterer, and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. Now, I'm no legal expert, but if I was a lawyer in that culture and the law that I was required to work with was the Mosaic law, and I was hired to be a defense attorney for this woman, I would argue and say, maybe it's a technicality, but according to the law of Moses, you're supposed to put both of them to death, and if you don't have the man on trial, you can't prove that she really did this. Therefore, I ask for a mistrial, Judge. Now, she's probably guilty of sin. I wouldn't say that. She's probably guilty of sin, but according to the law, you're supposed to execute the man and the woman, and I don't see the man around. He was not charged. He was not apprehended. Why is that? We know why, don't we? We know why. They were trying to trap Jesus. But I'm even just saying from a purely Mosaic standpoint, most people read this and say, well, you know, actually they have Jesus dead to rights. She should have been stoned under the law of Moses. I'm not so sure, because the man's not there, and the law says they're both to be stoned. And what happens in cases where the man's not there and the woman is? Or the other way around? The text says stone them both. And I'm not sure legally if you could do it with only one of them apprehended. You can't really have a full trial on a charge like that with only one person. So that's interesting to me. It's interesting, and as I mentioned earlier, it's interesting why they brought this to Jesus anyway. He was not a judge, for example, in the Sanhedrin. He was not someone with the authority under the Jewish system. I know Jesus has all authority. He's Lord. But, I mean, under their system, he's not one that has the authority to execute her. If they really were concerned about justice, which they're not, if they really cared about this woman being executed, they wouldn't have drug her to Jesus. They would have drug her to the court. That's who has the authority to execute her, so they don't care about that. It's an obvious trap, and Jesus knows it's a trap. That's why he doesn't fall into it. All right, so what does he do? And this is where it gets extremely interesting. Let's see, what verse? Law of Moses, they were saying to test him, verse 6, so they might have grounds for accusing him, but Jesus stooped down with his finger, wrote on the ground. They persisted in asking him. He straightened up and said, he who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone. All right, now that's very telling in that Jesus doesn't say, all right, you want a stoner, go ahead, start flinging rocks. Because that wasn't the way it was done with the stoning. It was very significant who threw the first stone, wasn't it? Because according to Mosaic law, the first stone was to be thrown by the accuser. That's who had to throw the first stone. So if you accuse somebody of something, you better mean business. Conversely, if you, and we've talked about this just recently, I can't remember when, but if you had an accusation against someone that turned out to be false, whatever you were going to do to them now happens to you. So you better mean business when you're going to bring a charge against somebody. You better have proof. And so it's interesting that Jesus brings that up, because to be the one to throw the first stone is to be the, you're the ringleader. You're the accuser. You're the one that's saying, I would stake my life on this person's guilt, and I will throw the first stone. Because by Jewish law, you were supposed to. You're the accuser. And so Jesus has a whole mob of these people. Oh, we caught her in the act. Of course, there's a little bit of courage in mobs, isn't there? You get a bunch of thugs together, they're a lot more brave than one scrawny little thug going up against a really big person or something. So they got a whole little group of them there. And, you know, this is a wolf pack. And Jesus says, okay, whichever one of you is without sin, go ahead, you be the first one to throw the stone. And it's almost like he's, okay, I'll watch which one of you is going to start. Now, that might make them a little more hesitant. Well, I'm all fine with stoning the woman. Actually, they just want to trap Jesus. I'm all fine with stoning the woman, but I don't want to be the one to lead the charge. Because what if her family comes back on me and says, oh, yeah, we know that you committed adultery with so-and-so. I mean, I could get myself killed. See, the problem is when you got corrupt people, investigating corrupt people. Sounds like Washington, doesn't it? What happens? What happens is sometimes one group will say, we know all the dirt he's done or she's done, but we can't really press it because they know all the dirt we've done. And so let's all just play nice, and we'll get up in front of the cameras and kind of gripe at each other a little bit, but we all got to watch it because we're all got blood on our hands. And I think that's kind of what's going on here. Why is nobody jumping up there to throw the first stone? It's interesting. Most of the time when you talk about this passage, people say, oh, yeah, well, Jesus wouldn't let them stone the woman caught in adultery. Not true. He told them to stone her. He said to stone her. He just put a condition upon it. Oh, let he who's without sin cast the first stone. Go right ahead. I mean, you would expect, I think most people, oh, Jesus wouldn't stand for this. You would expect Jesus to just say, no, she shall not be stoned. Come, I'll protect you and all this. He didn't. He said, let he who's without sin cast the first stone. Yeah, go ahead and stone her if you're without sin. By the way, who was the only one there qualified to stone her under that rule? Jesus was the only sinless one there, which is interesting. Okay, let's get to this part because I think this is the most fascinating part. He writes on the ground, okay? So they bring this to him, bring this case to him. This woman caught in adultery in the very act. We know she's guilty. They're eliminating all loopholes, except, of course, they didn't bring the man. It might have been one of them was the man. You never know. But we caught her in the very act. Moses says, stone her. What do you say? And Jesus doesn't even answer at first. He stoops down and starts writing on the ground. The Bible doesn't tell us what he wrote. I mean, isn't that interesting? Because from my perspective, I'm thinking, why do they even tell us Jesus wrote anything? It's like it's just designed to pique our curiosity. What did he write? I mean, wouldn't we just love to know? And we can all speculate, and a lot of people have. And some of the speculations, I think, are very plausible. But the text just doesn't tell us. And so whatever theory you have, it can't be more than a theory because the text doesn't tell us. But there are theories. And I'm going to give you some of them. Do you know any of them that you'd like to share? Okay. Okay. So maybe he was writing that. Especially if it was one of them's bedroom. Right. 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 Yep, yep. That is a theory as well. He could have, and there's one in particular he could have written, which I'll get to in a moment. Just a second. Bearing false witness is the one I'm thinking of. Anybody else have any? Yeah, yeah. A lot of people believe he was writing something from the Old Testament. Yeah. Maybe, or maybe some of the names of the mistresses of these men who weren't there. That's another theory. Okay, here's some of the theories, and you all hit on several of them. One theory that's kind of interesting is, and here's the thing, Jesus writes twice. He stoops down, he writes on the ground, they keep pestering him about what to do. He gets up, let he who is without sin cast the first stone, and then he goes back to writing again. All kinds of intrigue surrounding this whole scene. One theory is that Jesus wrote Jeremiah 17:13 in the ground, which says, Lord, you are the hope of Israel. All who forsake you will be put to shame. Those who turn away from you will be written in the dust because they have forsaken the Lord, the spring of living water. Now, that would be powerful, I would say. if he were to write that, because that describes them, doesn't it? I mean, they've turned away from the Lord, they've forsaken the Lord, and their names will be written in the dust. I mean, what if Jesus wrote that verse out? Now you say, what does it mean to be written in the dust? What's that referencing? Well, what that means is your name is written in the dust as opposed to written in stone. Written in stone, you're secure, right? Written in dust, you will be blotted out. And that's what he's saying. That's what Jeremiah is saying. Some say Jesus maybe wrote that. Some say Jesus wrote Exodus chapter 20, verse 1, which deals with bearing false witness and being a malicious witness. In other words, if you boys are lying, remember this. You're so big on the law. How about this one? Exodus 20, verse 1, it says, "You shall not bear a false report. Do not join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not follow the masses in doing evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after a multitude in order to pervert justice." Ooh, I mean, it's a lot of writing. But when you think of that one, do not follow the masses in doing evil and being a malicious witness. What if you're a part of that group that, you know, we need a big group here. We caught her in adultery, and you're sitting there thinking, this is not really legit. I mean, this is a setup. And now Jesus is quoting this verse. It's like he's talking directly to me here. This is creepy. And so he might have been doing that, following the masses. As some of you had mentioned, some have suggested that he was writing the names of the accuser's sins, like sins that he knew that they had committed, which would be awkward, to say the least, wouldn't it? Particularly if he's writing their names. Caiaphas, adultery with so-and-so, Annas, thievery, you know, whatever the sins were. But again, then some say that maybe not only the names of the accusers, but the name of the mistresses. Or it could be a combination of some of these. For example, he could have initially started writing one of the Bible verses I cited about your name will be written in the dust because you've forsaken the God of Israel. And then he gets up and says, "He who is without sin, cast the first stone." And they're still just kind of standing there. Then he goes back down and he starts writing, "Caiaphas, adultery with so-and-so." And then, boing, 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 they start leaving. any significance that the older ones left before the younger?
They had more time to sin.
There you go, maybe so. Man, he's pulling up stuff from 50 years ago. What kind of fresh stuff does he have on me? I better just get out of here. This is going to get ugly. Could be that, could be just the wisdom of age. Like, ugh. He's got us beat. Let's just get out of here. And the younger ones are still zealous. It's interesting. And at the end of the situation, the only one with the authority to stone her was Jesus. And he's the one that says, "I don't condemn you." And so grace and authority in the teaching of Jesus. Now, when you think of that, and you think, you know, back in Nazareth there, this is the type of teaching you're hearing. This is the type of teacher that Jesus was. It appeals to me as a Christian, doesn't it? Someone with authority and uses his authority to extend grace to me. He has the authority to cast me into hell, and I deserve it. He has the authority to pluck me out and cleanse me with his blood and take me to heaven. I don't deserve that. And so he's gracious with me, even though he has the authority to absolutely destroy me. And that, you know, I think when you hear Jesus teaching, even if when you read it, it comes out. But if you were there in person listening to him teach, you would be amazed at the gracious words falling from his lips. The people were amazed at what they heard. They were amazed and astonished at his authority. He doesn't teach like the scribes. What kind of man is this that he declares things not in a, you know, arrogant, doesn't know what he's talking about kind of way, but as in a he is God among us kind of way, authority and grace. And so that's what you see here with this story with the woman caught in adultery. As I said, they try to paint Jesus into a corner, and he won't go there. And you know, a lot of times people, they'll try to force you into a certain corner. Well, these are your two options. You don't have to take their two options. That's Jesus. I mean, they say two options, either stoner or disobey. And what does Jesus say? You stoner, if you're without sin. How do you answer that? You don't answer that. There's no answer for that. He totally baffles them. There's no comeback. I mean, if you're thinking about a debate there, dialogue and argumentation, well, you say that, and my argument back is this, and my argument back is this. You ever got ready to get into an argument, and you think about everything the other person might say, and then you've got it figured out how you're going to come back? If you're married, you've done this, I promise you. Not me and my wife, but all of you people probably have. What's she going to say? Well, if she does, I'm going to say this. Well, then I'm going to say this. Or if you're going to go in and, you know, whatever, you're going to talk to the car salesman. Well, he's going to try to do this. Well, I'm going to come back with this. And then he's going to say this, and I'm going to say that. Well, if that's what you're trying to do with Jesus, boy, you just might as well forfeit. Because no one ever caused him to stumble for a moment. We all get, you know, caught up in a debate or argument and say something stupid, or we get trapped. You know how it is. An hour later, you think of the perfect thing to say. You're driving home. Oh, that's what I should have said. But it's too late now. I missed my chance. I'll remember that one for next time, though. Jesus, it never worked. I mean, they try to trap him. Every way they try to trap him, it blows up in their face. Remember they tried to trap him on the whole John the Baptist thing? And they even figured out, well, but if we criticize John the Baptist, the people consider him a prophet. But then if we don't criticize John the Baptist, then he's going to say, well, why didn't you listen to John the Baptist then? They could not get him. And so, I mean, even, as I mentioned earlier, even if you're just going on sheer law of Moses grounds, I think you could get this thrown out by the fact that they didn't have the adulterer. But Jesus, not only... there's a technicality in the Mosaic law, but Jesus also expresses his supremacy over Moses. Something greater than Moses is here. And so they come and try to trip him up with this, and it just flat doesn't work. Of course, it ends with this, John 8, verse 10, "Woman, where are they? Did no one condemn you?" And she said, "No one, Lord." Now notice what Jesus says, because some people misinterpret this. Oh, well, Jesus is so gracious. Adultery is nothing to him. He doesn't care about adultery. He'll just forgive it. It's nothing. That's not what he says. He says, "I do not condemn you either. Go from now on, sin no more." He doesn't say go back to your adultery. I think the woman was guilty. She was an adulteress. But I do think she was probably set up. How did they know to catch her in the act? How do they know where she was? How do they know who she was with? This all seems like a setup. And the guy gets away. That's convenient. But Jesus says to her, "I don't condemn you. I don't condemn you. Go and sin no more." I mean, isn't that really how it is for a believer when they're born again? I mean, hey, maybe you weren't an adulterer, but trust me, you got plenty of sin. You've got... truckloads of damnable sin in your past with which Jesus could condemn you. In fact, if you got one, he could condemn you. And so Jesus could condemn each and every single one of us because we're rotten to the core by nature, and we express that rottenness in countless ways. And yet what does he say to his elect, to his sheep, to believers? "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." He doesn't say, "Go sin, it doesn't matter, I'll show you grace anyway because you're my elect." He says, "Go and sin no more." And guess what? If you're elect and born again, you don't want to sin. That's not what drives your life anymore, sin. I mean, sin eats you up when you're an unbeliever. That's all you can think about. Even your good thoughts are sin because usually they're self-serving. But when you're a believer, you don't want to sin anymore. You still sin, but it grieves you. It pains you. It convicts you. I don't want to be like that. And so that's what we see here. The people of Nazareth, this didn't happen in Nazareth, but that's the type of teaching that they hear. That's the type of teaching that they're amazed at. And strangely enough, and we'll get to this next time, it's the type of teaching that it makes them want to kill Jesus. Why would you want to kill someone who teaches that authoritative and gracious type of way? Well, they had their reasons. They weren't good, but they had their reasons. And we'll get to that next time.